On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
A little less than a century ago, the idea of female pilots was outright disparaged in newspapers by columnists and in front page headlines. The idea of women even wanting to fly was seen as somewhat suspect. So it makes it even more remarkable when we realize that there were women flyers back 90 and 80 years ago, and we don't know who they are. Their names, except for Amelia Earhart, have slipped into history. Keith O'Brien, former reporter for the Boston Globe and frequent contributor to National Public Radio, has a new book that seeks to rectify those misconceptions and to right the record. His book, Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. It's from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And the website for the book, where you can find all sorts of interesting things, is flygirlsbook.com. We're delighted to welcome for his first time, but I hope not this last, to On the Bookshelf, Keith O'Brien.
Thanks so much for having me.
I saw there was little irony in how you got connected with the story of Fly Girls.
Yeah, isn't it a cosmic irony? I was on an airplane in June, early June of 2016. I was flying from Boston to Pittsburgh that day for a story I was doing for Politico magazine. And I was reading a different book on the flight. And in this book early on, there was just one line in a historical background paragraph about daring women in the early part of the 20th century. And this one line mentioned an all-female airplane race in 1929 that had featured Amelia Earhart. And, you know, the line just stopped me because, of course, I had heard of Amelia Earhart, but I had never heard of Earhart racing or frankly, anyone racing airplanes. And, you know, it just stopped me, and it rattled around in my head for some time. And, you know, I did next what any good journalist would do. I just sort of pulled the string and see where it led me. And, you know, within a short period of time, I was, in the library, you know, immersing myself in old microfilm from newspaper coverage of these air races in the late 1920s. And once I was there doing that, this world of the air races revealed itself, and it was just a fascinating place.
I'd have to say most of the newspaper writers of the time seem pretty crass and tacky, personally attacking the women who want to be aviators as unfeminine or incapable of realizing how tough it was really supposed to be and so forth. They never really talked to any of these women, apparently, if that's what they thought.
Well, that's right. You know, in the late 1920s, there was just aviation was still quite young as an industry, and it was almost exclusively dominated by men. You know, just to give people an idea of what I'm talking about, you know, in 1928, the presidential election of 1928, 90 years ago, there were 29 million women in this country who were eligible to vote, 29 million. Of that number, 29 million, fewer than a dozen, fewer than 12, had a pilot's license on file with the U.S. Department of Commerce, which was the regulating agency at the time. Now, that number's a bit soft. It's certainly not capturing all of the women who were flying planes at that time. There was still a little bit of a Wild West element to aviation. But the fact is, you know, in the late 1920s, the number of women flying planes in this country was a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of the population of women in America. And that really did make the few women who flew planes and then raced planes, it made them real radical.
They absolutely were pioneers. Now, of course, there weren't that many men pilots either, and most of them had been flyers in World War I or learned to fly after that from someone who had military service. One of the things that I learned from reading Keith O'Brien's Fly Girls is that there were so few women in the country with licenses that when they formed a club and invited all the women in the country to join, they had 99 members, and so that's what they named the club.
Right, and that's at the end of 1929. They sent out invitations to all 117 licensed female pilots in this country, 117. And they received affirmative replies from 99, and that's why they call themselves the 99s. And you know, I do want to be clear, you know, to your listeners, that this is not intended to be a comprehensive history of women in aviation in the 1920s and 30s, where each woman gets her own chapter, you know, that kind of boilerplate history. That is not what I set out to do. That is not what I have done. Mm-hmm. This is a narrative. You know, this is one specific story about a handful of friends, really, you know, good friends who fought together for the right to fly and race airplanes. And that's really, you know, what this book is about, is an ensemble cast of friends on this epic quest for equality in the sky.
I like the fact that even though they were fierce competitors, they were also friends, and they were fellow pioneers in this bold new venture of acclimating people to the idea that women could be pilots too. They write to each other, they see each other, they fly against each other, but they are friends. Of course, we have to remember that sometimes they lost those friends in plane crashes. This was a very dangerous thing. These people are basically flying kites with faster and faster engines. And sometimes the centrifugal force just rips the planes apart, and there's nothing anybody can do except crash. If they're high enough up, maybe they have a parachute that'll open, but sometimes they weren't high enough up even for that to do them any good. And sometimes they rode with the plane to crash it in a controlled way so that it wouldn't hurt civilians.
That's right. Not all of these characters will survive the narrative. And that's the thing that you know, really blew me away. You know, when men crashed, or when men died, as they inevitably did competing in these air races in the 1920s and 30s, they were treated as heroes. And often giving grand tributes right there on the field that very weekend, with 21 gun salutes and flybys and moments of silence. And when women died and crashed and died in these races, as again they inevitably did, they did not get the same kind of treatment. And in fact, they sometimes didn't even get the most basic, decent human respect. There was a shocking and infuriating double standard during this time. You know, there are times in this story where some of the characters, some of these women, die, and it is no fault of their own. The plane has failed, a mechanical failure. Everyone has seen it happen, you know, tens of thousands of witnesses, and yet in the next day's newspaper, they're blaming the woman for having crashed and for having died. It was really infuriating to read.
It was pretty upsetting to find out they just wrapped her body in newspaper and put it in a pine box and shipped it back with no more respect than that. It wasn't until another male pilot flying the identical plane had a crash in the identical fashion that the average people began to realize that this was just as dangerous for the women as it was for the men, and it had nothing to do with their relative strength or anything else. They were all good flyers, but they were doing something that was inherently very dangerous.
And that's why, you know, these women had to stick together, and they knew it. You know, they knew that they were all connected to one another for better or for worse, that each of their victories was a victory for all, and more notably, each of their failures was a failure for all of them. And that really is why they knew they had to stick together. And so even when, you know, one of them would win the race, or one of them would beat the other across the ocean, you know, they were there to cheer one another on, even amid their disappointment.
We're talking to Keith O'Brien, the author of Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. It's from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And by the way, his website is flygirlsbook.com. Let's talk about some of these amazing women, these female aviation pioneers. These women are flying at faster and faster speeds, cross-country, and in many ways they didn't have much to go on as far as landmarks. There were very few roads. And railroads weren't always safe to follow either.
Well, that's right. You know, when this story begins in 1927, if you were to fly across the country, you would need to use road maps and railroad maps and landmarks on the ground to get you across. And, you know, it was impossible to fly in low cloud cover, fog, rain, or snow. And indeed, pilots were instructed in the late 1920s that, you know, if you were to get caught in a storm, what you wanted to do was to fly low, identify railroad tracks, and then follow the tracks, which presumably would lead you to the next town. But even that wasn't necessarily safe, because there were accounts of pilots following railroad tracks, flying low to see where they were going, and then plowing right into a mountainside as the railroad ducked into a tunnel.
Many of these flyers were quite good, and we might say they were legendary, except for the sad truth that most of them are not remembered at all anymore. If not for Keith's book, I wouldn't have heard of any of these flyers except for Amelia Earhart, and I've only known about her because of what happened at the end of her life. And some of these women paid with their lives for their dream of flying and their dream of setting records and winning races and so forth. They're worth remembering. It's worth remembering that Amelia Earhart was the first woman to fly across the Atlantic, that she had other things that she did that were spectacular as well. But it's also important for us to know about Ruth Nichols and Louise Thaden and Ruth Elder from Anniston, Alabama, and Florence Klingensmith and all the other ladies.
And most people haven't, you know, even sometimes in their hometown. You know, as part of my research here, I try to track down personal archives, you know, the memos, letters, diaries of all of these women, and reached out to a great many museums in order to do so. And, you know, I called the Historical Society right there in Alabama, in Anniston, the hometown of Ruth Elder. And Ruth Elder was, in the late 1920s, one of the most famous women in America, period. Not just female aviators, one of the most famous women in America. It is Ruth Elder, there from Alabama, who in September 1927, just a few months after Lindbergh has flown the Atlantic, she is declaring she wants to be the first woman to do it. And she will set off on this flight right about this time of year, October 1927, Ruth Elder will attempt to be the first woman to cross the Atlantic by plane. And, you know, it is only because of her failure to make it that it opens the door for Amelia Earhart to make her flight 9 months later. But, you know, by the end of 1927, because of this effort, because of this attempted flight, Ruth Elder has made headlines around the world. And you know, when I called, just, you know, 18 months ago, the Historical Society in Anniston, Alabama, to inquire about what they might have, you know, on file about Ruth Elder, they didn't even know who she was. And that's how much these women have been forgotten. Well, you know, when we think about Amelia Earhart, we tend to think about her flying solo across the ocean. And of course she did that, but that's not how she initially became famous or became known. In 1928, just several months after Ruth Elder's failed flight across the Atlantic, wealthy men, including Amelia Earhart's future husband, the New York publisher George Putnam, plucked Amelia Earhart from obscurity in Boston. She was a licensed pilot. She'd been flying since 1921. But at that time, 1928, Amelia Earhart, by her own admission, wasn't doing much flying anymore. She was a social worker in Boston, serving new immigrants to this country, helping to teach them English. It is here, at this settlement house for immigrants, that Amelia Earhart is discovered. And she is put on a plane flown by men across the ocean in June 1928. Earhart's only job on this flight is to sit and take notes for a book that she will write for George Putnam. And, you know, this flight, when it lands safely in a seaplane in the water off the coast of Wales, makes Amelia Earhart famous around the world, with grand parades, ticker tape parades, you know, on two continents. to her credit, Amelia knows that what she's done is really nothing. She says that I'm just cargo on that flight, a sack of potatoes. And in the rest of what will be a very short life, it's 9 more years. It's 9 years in the spotlight. That's all she has. Amelia Earhart will make daring flights in an effort to prove that women can do anything that a man can do. And also in an effort to answer her critics, because, you know, it would come to a surprise to most people to learn that Amelia Earhart did have critics.
It seems strange now, because she is still well known. Some of the critics that she had were the same criticisms that other female pilots had, that they were just in it as a fluke, or that they were just in it because they wanted to look nice in the outfit or something. Just goofy stuff that people wrote and should have been ashamed of writing. Ruth Nichols, she grows up rich. Her parents have her future all planned out. She's not interested in that. She wants to be a flyer, and she turns out to be one of the great ones, too. Tell us a little bit about Ruth Nichols.
Ruth Nichols, as you indicated, she was the daughter, really, of Wall Street wealth, born on the Upper East Side of New York and raised in Tony, Westchester County, just outside of New York City. And, you know, until the stock market crash in 1929, the Nichols family had money. But what Ruth desperately wanted was everything that Amelia had. And she will really, more than any other woman, Ruth Nichols will challenge Amelia Earhart for the title of most accomplished female aviator in this country. And indeed, really, by 1931, Ruth Nichols, just objectively speaking, has eclipsed Earhart. She has the speed record, the altitude record, the transcontinental speed record. And it is Ruth Nichols, not Amelia Earhart, but Ruth Nichols, who in June 1931 will attempt to be the first woman to fly solo, all by herself, in the cockpit of a small single-engine Lockheed flying over the North Atlantic. And, you know, were it not for happenstance and bad luck, Ruth Nichols may have gotten there first. And had she done that, you know, it would have reset everything that we know today about women and aviation in the 1920s and 30s in this country. And there may be statues and streets for Ruth Nichols, not Amelia Earhart.
Now, Louise Thaden, I've got to admit that she ended up kind of being my favorite of all the ones in the book, because she tries to have it all. She ends up getting married to the guy who designs her plane. She has children, and she's trying to be a good mom, but she also misses being a flyer, so she gets back in the game. She outlives all of them. That's a joy that somebody got to live to be old, because most of these women didn't, and most of these early men flyers didn't. She had some pretty significant flight credentials as well.
Louise Thaden was a champion air racer, and, you know, if she had the publicity machine that Amelia Earhart had, if she was married, say, to a major New York publisher like George Putnam, I guarantee you that people today would have known Louise Thaden. But she was not. You know, she was married to a humble plane builder, and, you know, she, as you said, you know, had two children. One in 1930, one in 1933. Most of the women who flew during this time did not have children. It is one of the rarest clubs of them all to be a mother and be competing in the sky during this era. It just didn't happen. And so, you know, because of the sacrifices that Louise made, and really because of her modesty, even in victory, you know, she slipped from our memories. And you know, when she died in the late 1970s, all the national newspapers that had once covered her and followed her around this country in the 1930s did not even write her obituary, did not even carry her obituary. She had completely slipped away, you know, right in front of our eyes. And so, you know, it is, you know, really my hope that with this book, with Flag Girl, that will help to bring Louise Sadin and these other women, you know, back to life on the pages of the book, and really remind readers of this time and these characters, you know, women who stood up for themselves and each other again and again, you know, defiant in the face of rules that were intended to keep them in their place, and also, you know, confident in the knowledge of who they were.
Louise Sadin wins the Bendix, the big race. She wins all the prize money. She wins the big, ostentatious Bendix trophy. It's more than 3 feet tall, weighs 100 pounds, and came with a purse of 15 grand. And thanks to your book, we know who these women are again. You've given them a new opportunity to gain their place in history. They deserve it. They were pioneers. They were courageous. And they flew despite all the discouragement they got from the mainstream press and all the disdain they put up with from a lot of the mail flyers. They are remarkable women. When one of their friends crashed and they got killed, it broke their hearts, but they kept flying. They kept going because they knew they had to. Otherwise, all those naysayers would have been proved right, that women really didn't deserve or need to fly, that it was too dangerous, that they needed to be protected. They didn't want that. They wanted to prove that women could do everything that a man could do in a situation like this. And they proved themselves.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. That means a lot. So the website is flygirlsbook.com. Again, flygirlsbook.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Keith O-B, K-E-I-T-H-O-B. On the website, listeners will find a photo gallery where they can see some of the women we've discussed today. Also, a video trailer for the book is on the website where people can see actual old footage of these women, which really helped to bring them back to life and really see who they were.
I would love to see your book made into a documentary. I have to be honest with you. I just think that would be amazing. But I certainly enjoyed reading it and learning about these remarkable women and feeling that now I had met some more people to admire in my life, and that's a great thing indeed. Keith O'Brien, our guest today, his new book, Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. It is from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and once again, you can check the website, flygirlsbook.com. Keith, thanks again for joining us on The Bookshelf.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let me leave you with these thoughts from Fly Girls. In 1926, there were countless ways to die in an airplane. Propeller blades snapped and broke, and planes went down. Wings failed, folding backward or tearing away completely. Control sticks got stuck, sending airships hurtling toward crowds or hangars. And all too often, engines just stopped in mid-flight, forcing pilots to scan the ground below for a farmer's field or cow pasture, anywhere they might land in a hurry. In such a crisis, there's no time to think, said one airway pilot. You either automatically do the right thing or you die. In clear skies, pilots often made the wrong choice. In bad weather, they had even fewer options. Storms, squalls, rain, snow, and fog made flying almost impossible. In open cockpit planes, raindrops felt to pilots like little bullets hurled at their faces at 100 miles an hour. Goggles fogged up, paper maps blew away in the wind, and aviators became disoriented. A pilot, in moments like these, was instructed to find railroad tracks on the ground and follow them. By doing so, a lost flyer could find the nearest town. But flying at 120 miles an hour just 50 feet off the tracks was treacherous, too. Worse, pilots could do everything right and still lose for reasons out of their control. In the 1920s, plane builders typically used wood to construct their machines and stretched linen over the wings like pillowcases and pulled the thin fabric tight around the spruce spars. These lightweight materials covered in a protective lacquer helped make flying possible, but the wood could rot and the fabric could tear, dooming even the best flyers. As one aviation manual pointed out, many pilots have been killed in wood fuselage ships. Crashes in 1926 killed or maimed 240 people. The vast majority of Americans never flew, and the government couldn't be sure it was counting every accident. Plane manufacturers had no required regulations, and instructors no required training. By the mid-1920s, the fledgling aircraft industry, eager to prove planes were safe, latched onto one idea capable of creating positive news coverage, marketable heroes, and excitement all at once: plane racing. These races were often fatal for pilots. In 1926, a new generation of female pilots was emerging, and they refused to be pigeonholed, mocked, or excluded. Instead, they united to fight the men in a singular moment in American history. That's the opening of Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History, by Keith O'Brien. And our thanks once again to Keith O'Brien, the author of Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. It's from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Once again, the website, flygirlsbook.com. Next week, Veterans Day, and we've got a very special program planned for that, so we hope that you'll join us again next week. In the meantime, check out the website, WTBFradio.com. We're loading up on the bookshelves, archiving them there, and hopefully on the bookshelf.biz, we'll be back up and running again soon. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.